this point in the game, she was helping out of her own anger over the murder of her friend Lauren and her adopted niece, Lucy. Getting one of the few true friends he had left in the world arrested or killed wasn't part of Reese's plan. It's now or never. Reese took a deep breath and tightened his grip on the handgun inside his backpack. As he made his way quickly down the stairs, he heard the sliding doors open on the van. Liz obviously had eyes on the steps in her rearview mirror and had pressed the button to open the automatic doors. He saw the van's brake lights come on, indicating that Liz had put the vehicle into gear and was ready to go. He scanned the parking lot as inconspicuously as possible as he walked down the sidewalk that ran parallel to the van. His knees still throbbed a bit from his PLF onto the platform, but he was confident that the injury was relatively minor and he could run if he had to. As his forward progress brought him alongside the van, he reached in and grabbed the inside handle, slinging himself into the back seat. The van lurched forward as soon as his feet left the sidewalk, and Liz sped toward the station exit. Reese drew the Glock from inside the pack as the sliding doors began to close, alert for anything out of the ordinary. Liz turned underneath the rail line and onto West 20th Street, making a quick turn left and then gunning the engine to merge onto the Hialeah Expressway. If the feds were going to make a traffic stop, they would have done it before now. She glanced up into the rearview mirror through her aviation glasses.
"You okay, Bubba?"
Reese breathed a sigh of relief. "Better now. Thanks for the pickup. How'd you get wheels?"
"FBOs almost always have cars or vans that you can borrow. They make so much money selling you fuel that they'll do anything to make you happy. Did you wreck your friend's truck already?"
"I did. I'll tell you about it in the air. People here drive like shit."
"You've destroyed two perfectly good vehicles in like 24 hours. People are going to stop lending you stuff."
As they drove eastward paralleling the Metro Rail tracks, it became obvious that they were retracing Reese's path from just minutes earlier.
"Don't say a word, Reese. I've never been to this city in my life."
"I didn't say a thing, Liz. Just do your thing." They turned left at East 8th Avenue, and the neighborhood became even more residential. It occurred to Reese that if he had to bail out of the vehicle, this maze of houses, fences, and small backyards would make pursuit difficult unless the cops brought in a helo. He took note when they crossed a small canal, undoubtedly made when the land was drained to make it a hospitable suburbia. As they neared the airport, the scene became increasingly industrial. Their path took them through warehouses with loading docks, building supply companies, and auto repair shops. Reese was pretty sure he'd seen a gunfight scene in an old episode of Miami Vice that was filmed in this area.
"Anything hit the news about me yet?" Reese asked.
"Not yet. I figured it would have by now. They're still saying the attack on the Admiral was either terrorism or workplace violence, depending on which news channel you watch."
"They know. All they need to do is talk to Tedesco's wife and the pieces will fall into place. They're probably figuring out their plan before hitting the news outlets."
Reese could hear a private jet on final approach above them as Liz drove north through an intersection. The light turned yellow as she crossed the parallel street, and she hit the accelerator so as not to run a red light. As if in slow motion, the light turned red above them as a green and white Miami-Dade police Dodge Charger sat at the traffic light to their right. The police car turned right and sped up behind them.
Chapter 61.
"Oh, shit, Reese, so sorry."
The Charger maintained its pace just a few feet behind the minivan for an agonizing 10 seconds.
"Maybe he won't pull us over," she said hopefully.
Just then, the red and blue light bar illuminated and the siren let loose a short blast that made Liz jump in her seat. She checked her mirror as she engaged her turn signal and pulled over to the curb.
"Don't say a word, Reese, and please don't shoot him,"
Liz said, remembering her grandfather.
"Check."
Reese faced forward and slipped the Glock under his right thigh, putting both hands on his knees where they would be easily seen. Liz put the vehicle in park and removed the University of Alabama ball cap from her head. She quickly pulled the elastic band from her ponytail and flipped her head side to side to let her hair down. With her right hand, she tugged at her tank top to expose as much cleavage as she could and put on her most seductive smile. The officer who appeared at the window was young, fit, and Latin, with a uniform that was meticulously pressed. Liz thought he looked like a guy you'd see in a Spanish-language soap opera, which made her own acting performance that much easier. She pulled off her Ray-Bans to give him a look into her blue eyes. Her ample southern accent became even more pronounced as she addressed the officer while sounding like a character from Gone with the Wind.
"I am so sorry, officer. That light changed and I didn't know what to do."
Despite the gravity of the situation, Reese nearly burst out laughing. "Can I see your license, registration, and proof of insurance, please, ma'am?"
"Yes, sir. Of course."
She retrieved her license from a small zippered bag on the passenger seat and opened the glove box to look for the rest of the documents. When Reese noticed the officer's eyes shift to check out Liz's fit body instead of watching her hands for a weapon, he was pretty sure that her acting job was paying off.
"This is a loaner van from the airport's FBO, so I hope it has everything in here."
She was relieved to see a short stack of paperwork when she opened the compartment and grabbed the entire pile. She thumbed through the documents on her lap and quickly found a Florida vehicle registration sheet and a small insurance card. She placed her license on top and handed the stack to the stone-faced officer.
"I'm so sorry. I'm a pilot and had to pick up my client in Miami Lakes. I don't know this area and was trying to do too many things at once."
The officer glanced at Reese in the back seat and held his stare for several seconds, clearly sizing him up. Despite his disheveled appearance, Reese put on the most pleasant face possible.
"I'll be right back, ma'am."
The officer retreated to his patrol car, where Reese assumed he was running both Liz and the van in his computer database. They were about to find out very quickly whether he was the subject of a nationwide manhunt, and if anyone in the law enforcement community had tied him to Liz Riley.
"I don't want to shoot this poor bastard, but hope is never a good plan. If there is even a hint he is onto us, I need to disable him, his vehicle, and his radio and drive east to find a marina, steal a boat and head offshore. Think with your dick, officer."
Reese shifted his eyes between the watch on his wrist and the rearview mirror, counting the minutes and looking for any sign that the officer was making a radio call. 4 minutes passed before the door opened on the police car. Reese studied the officer's body language as he approached. His right hand held a metal ticket book, not his sidearm, and his left hand hung calmly at his side. His stride showed swagger rather than fear. Any sane human approaching someone who they thought was an armed and dangerous domestic terrorist suspect would approach with more caution or stay in their car and call in SWAT. The officer rested the metal ticket book on the van's windowsill where Liz could read it.
"Ma'am, I've written you a warning for failure to obey a traffic control device, which would have cost you $204 and 3 points on your license. If you're a pilot, you should be more careful than that. Please sign the warning on the bottom line."
Liz leaned forward to sign the warning and made sure to allow the officer as much of a view down her tank top as possible. It worked, as he paid no attention to Reese whatsoever.
"That is very understanding of you, officer. Thank you so much for not giving me a ticket."
"Yes, ma'am. Please have a good day and try to be more careful. This copy is yours. If I pull you over again, I'm going to have to write you a ticket."
"Yes, sir. I promise that won't happen."
The officer finally broke into a smile and nodded to Liz. "Please have a safe flight, Miss Riley."
"Oh, I will. Thank you so much, sir."
The officer was nearly blushing as he turned to walk back to his car. When he got to the rear of the minivan, he came to a dead stop, paused, and turned back toward the window. Reese subconsciously flexed his right hand and took a deep breath to fight his racing heart rate. The officer stooped downward so that he had a direct view at Reese.
"Sir, why don't you have any luggage?"
Reese did his best to force a smile.
"I just flew down here to look at some real estate. I didn't stay overnight, so what little I brought is in the plane."
The officer stared at Reese for a moment, looked back at Liz, and nodded his head.
Safe travels. Holy fuck, that was close. Liz started the van and put it into gear, pulling onto the road before the officer had even returned to his charger. Reese felt the surge of euphoria that always followed a life-or-death encounter. His head began to swim with endorphins the way it usually did after a successful mission or firefight overseas.
Reese, do you mind if your pilot for this evening is intoxicated?
Reese exhaled a giant lung full of air. I'll tell you what, I have never been so glad to have a hot female gym rat for a pilot. Liz looked back at Reese in the mirror and flashed an embarrassed grin. She immediately pulled her top up and reached over to put her hat on. 10 minutes later, she was all business as she meticulously went through the pre-flight checklist. Neither Reese nor Liz's blood pressures began to return to normal until they were wheels up over northern Dade County. Chapter 62. The Pentagon, Arlington County, Virginia. Generals Lewandowski and Stewart waited in the secure conference room. They were given specific instructions not to include any deputies or aides in the meeting, which was highly unusual, if not unprecedented. Lewandowski was nearing the end of his tenure as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He had been a stud fighter pilot, one of the few fortunate enough to see air-to-air combat during Operation Desert Storm. He also played the political game well enough to have risen to the pinnacle of the military food chain. Mentally, he already had one foot out the door as he looked forward to sitting on a few corporate boards in retirement. He had a laid-back demeanor that made him well-liked among both his fellow generals and the men serving below him. Ewell Stewart was very much the opposite, intense, opinionated, and decisive. A native of rural Virginia and direct descendant of Civil War General Jeb Stuart, General Stewart was probably liked by no one, but respected by all. He'd spent his early career as an infantry officer in the Ranger Battalions before being selected for the Army's Special at Fort Bragg. He was currently in charge of the Joint Special Operations Command. Neither man liked or respected Secretary Hartley, though both understood and valued the U.S. tradition of civilian control of the military. Hartley was a pure politician, checking the SecDef box to build her credentials for a White House run. It wasn't just that she was a phony who didn't take the job seriously. It was her blatant practice of funneling every dollar she could muster through her husband's consulting firm that they found so offensive. If you wanted to sell a fighter jet, aircraft carrier, or armored vehicle to the military, you'd better hire J.D. Hartley. Want the contract to run the mess hall at Bagram? Retain J.D. Hartley. The Hartleys treated the Pentagon like the world's largest ATM machine. Like many politicians, Lorraine Hartley had started out with good intentions. As a college student, with the help of a few of the more radical faculty members, she became outraged at what she came to see as injustices imposed by the U.S. government on countries around the globe. When she met J.D., she found a partner who would help her change the world. After J.D.'s election to Congress, their lives transformed dramatically. Everywhere she went, she was told how great she was, how smart she was, how talented she was. Before long, she was believing every word of it. The entitled behavior of both Congressman and Mrs. Hartley became increasingly outrageous, but in D.C. there were always suit-clad enablers willing to keep things quiet. By the time she was appointed Secretary of Defense, Madam Hartley had become the epitome of what her 20-year-old self had sought to stand up against. Both men had busy calendars, and it was 15 minutes after the scheduled meeting time when the SecDef finally arrived with her deputy secretary and young female aide carrying an iPad. The message was clear. You can't bring your staff, but I can bring mine. You weren't supposed to bring electronic devices into a secure room such as this, but neither man was willing to fall on a sword over that point. She greeted both men with a plastic smile before taking her seat at the head of the conference table. She was wearing a classic black suit made by St. John Knits, her usual attire. Her propensity for wearing all black, concocted after a focus group determined she was most trusted in that color, combined with her sour demeanor,
was the reason for her nickname among the military officers who worked around her. The Undertaker. Though no one ever dared use the moniker in front of her, her network of civilian rats let her know that she was so named. The fact that she was viewed as intimidating and insensitive pleased her. The Joint Chiefs don't have direct command authority over military units. That structure flows directly from the SecDef to the combatant commands. Though previous SecDefs relied upon the Joint Chiefs for their advice and expertise, Hartley rarely did. Secretary Hartley acted as if Lewandowski weren't even in the room, as she directed her comments only to General Stewart.
"I've just come from a meeting with the Secretary of Homeland Security. The blast that killed Admiral Pilsner came from a suicide vest. The man wearing the vest was a financier with no terror connections, and he did so because his family was being held hostage."
She left out the fact that she'd known Mike Tedesco for well over 10 years.
"The man who strapped the vest on him was a SEAL officer, the one who led that shit show in Afghanistan that got everyone killed. We have reliable information that he's hiding out in some shack in New Hampshire. My people can provide you with the details. General Stewart, I want your SEALs up there as soon as humanly possible. One of our contract security firms will send a team to accompany them."
"I'm sorry, ma'am, but as I'm sure you're aware, the Posse Comitatus Act prevents us from using military forces in such a role on U.S. soil. This is an FBI mission," Stewart responded.
"I didn't ask you for a legal opinion, General. I went to Harvard Law School and don't want or need you to tell me what I can and can't do. I'm telling you to get your SEALs on a plane and get their asses to New Hampshire."
"I cannot give that order, ma'am. It violates the Constitution."
"Fuck the Constitution!"
The SecDef's aide, who hadn't said a word thus far, glanced up from her iPad and interrupted.
"Actually, Madam Secretary, it's not in the Constitution. Posse Comitatus is part of the U.S. Code. It's federal law. It didn't even apply to the Navy until 1992.
The SecDef looked annoyed at her aide for the correction, but directed her anger back at General Stewart.
"What are you, a fucking Eagle Scout? You give that order, or not only will I demand your resignation and get it, but I will make sure that your beloved command is defunded into obscurity and that your men are reassigned to conventional units. You will be responsible for the death of special operations."
Stewart sat back, stunned.
"What's it going to be, Stewart? Are you going to give the order, or do I have to keep firing generals until I find one that will do his job?"
Chapter 63. Senior Chief Fred Strain had sent the recall text out to the Iridium satellite pagers of the operators in his assault team less than an hour ago. There was no excuse for missing that recall, and now each member of his 8-man team was assembled in the conference space attached to their squadron room.
"All right, guys, this is a friggin' crazy one."
Fred was trying to stop swearing so much. He gave it up along with drinking after his wife gave him an ultimatum. "Stop drinking or leave the teams." Fred had stopped drinking. He almost shook his head as he chose his next words carefully.
"We are going after one of our own. Are you all aware of what happened at Warcom?"
Heads nodded up and down. It had been hard to miss. The media loved the SEALs these days. Even before the Bin Laden mission catapulted them to cult hero status, there had been movies, books, video games, and other high-profile missions that had brought them into the spotlight.
"You're not going to believe this, but the evidence is pointing to a SEAL as a perpetrator."
Looks of disbelief were shared among the group. Nobody liked Warcom, and everyone had an intense dislike for the current admiral, but to blow him up? That seemed a bit out there. The current working theory in the media was that it was an Islamic terrorist group seeking retribution.
"Who's the guy, Senior?" one of the younger SEALs asked.
Fred paused. He almost couldn't bring himself to say it.
"Lieutenant Commander James Reese."
"No fucking way," the younger SEAL shouted, shaking his head. "No fucking way. He was my platoon commander before I came here. Total stud. Prior enlisted, he gets it. No way that guy did this." Enlisted SEALs' contempt for officers was well documented. Every now and again, there would be one who broke the mold, who was admired for his leadership, battlefield prowess, aggressiveness, and character. James Reese was one such man.
Sorry, Smitty. It looks like it's true.
Well, if he did this, he had one damn good reason.
Doesn't matter the reason, Smitty. He did it. Plain and simple. I knew him as well. We were paired up in sniper school and operated together back in the early days, as solid as they come. His family has a long history in the teams.
Did he skip the country, Fred? Is that why they called us in?
Another SEAL asked.
Well, now, here is where it gets a bit convoluted. You are all going to be asked to sign additional non-disclosures for what is about to happen.
Really? Smitty piped in. More non-disclosures? You mean the 100 other ones we signed don't cover this? What the fuck, Senior?
Just listen up, Smitty, and let me get through this.
Sorry, Senior.
Okay. This is an unprecedented situation. This SEAL, who, as we can see from what he did at Warcom, is not your typical officer who just does his two platoons and then goes to a staff job for the next 15 to 25 years. This guy knows what he's doing. A SEAL domestic terrorist. It's bound to hit the news soon. They're still calling it an act of terrorism, but that's going to change in short order, and we want to be up and out of here before it does, so it doesn't put him more on edge than he already is. He is still in the country, and the SecDef wants him apprehended as soon as possible.
Fred, I haven't been paying much attention to the West Coast stuff in the news. How many people did he kill at Warcom with that blast?
Asked one of the team's more laid-back guys, who looked like he was in a perpetual state of drunkenness.
That's just the thing. Only two. The Admiral and some L.A. finance guy. The Admiral's aide had his eardrums blown out, but other than that, no one else was injured. Apparently, he wrapped this L.A. guy in an S-vest, took his family hostage, and made him detonate himself in the Admiral's office.
No way,
said the laid-back operator, finally showing signs of waking up.
That's hardcore shit. I'm starting to like this guy. Cut it out, Paul,
Fred said curtly.
This is serious business. We cannot underestimate him. This is a mission just like any other. Put the fact that he is a SEAL out of your minds, except in the context that we are going up against a formidable adversary. He's had a lot of the same training that we have and has seen his share of combat. Whatever his beef was with the Admiral and this finance guy is none of our concern. What is our concern? Is planning a mission to kill or capture this HVI,
he said, intentionally verbalizing the high-value individual terminology used overseas.
Hey, Fred, you said he was still in the U.S., commented one of the more thoughtful SEALs in the group. How can we go after him here? Doesn't posse comitatus still apply?
That's where the non-disclosures come in, gentlemen. SecDef has suspended posse comitatus through an executive order signed by the president. We will be operating on U.S. soil using all assets at our disposal to kill or capture our target.
What? Can she even do that? Why us?
Why not just use HRT?
The SEAL asked, using the acronym for the FBI's elite hostage rescue team.
SecDef wants us.
Strain hesitated.
She wants us because, according to her intelligence sources, Reese's next target is the president.
Eyebrows went up around the table as the gravity and complexity of the situation unfolded before them. Fred paused, scanning the room.
If anyone has a problem with going after this target or operating on U.S. soil, let me know now.
Nobody moved.
Okay, then. He's in a cabin in the mountains of New Hampshire. I don't know how they know this. The target package is slim. It says single-source human with no technical corroboration. Like I said, this is a weird one. There is a bird waiting on us at NAS Oceania,
Fred continued, referencing the Naval Air Station down the road from base.
We need to be airborne in an hour. We will cover specifics when we land in Vermont. From there, we will make our way into New Hampshire. There is no time to more fully vet this or let it develop. SecDef wants this done yesterday, and we are the force of choice. Any questions?
Fred looked from one operator to the next. Fred regretted the next words that came out of his mouth as soon as he said them.
You don't have to like it, you just have to do it.
What a dumbass thing to say, he thought.
Smitty, a word please,
Fred said as the crew got up to grab their gear and head to the airfield.
Yes, Senior?
Smitty asked as soon as the door was closed.
Smitty, you are one hell of an operator, and I'd want you by my side going through a door any time.
But?
But? You won't be coming with us on this. And,
the team chief quickly added,
before you protest or say anything else, this is not your decision. I am ordering you off the mission. I can't have guys that know and respect Reese on this op. I know you understand.
Smitty tried to hide the relief on his face. He was conflicted like never before. He couldn't let his team down, nor could he go after the man he looked up to as the best combat leader he had ever worked with. Someone he would follow into the fires of hell. Taking the decision out of his hands was the sign of a good leader. Smitty simply nodded, bowed his head, and walked from the room without his usual energy. Fred took a breath.
Son of a bitch,
he whispered to no one but himself. Taking another deep breath, he strode from the room to ready his gear. Chapter 64. The Pentagon, Arlington County, Virginia. The story preempted every network broadcast and monopolized the cable news channels. Off-the-record quotes from senior officials at the Department of Defense were used to tease the story, ensuring massive coverage. Anchors gave viewers a countdown to the primetime press conference that would be given by Secretary of Defense Lorraine Hartley, while reporters broadcasting from the dozens of satellite trucks crowded in front of the gates of the Naval Amphibious Base Coronado referenced reports of a domestic terrorist being responsible for the blast that killed decorated SEAL Admiral Gerald Pilsner. At 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, Secretary Hartley strode confidently toward the blue lectern at the Pentagon in a somber black suit. Her face exuded competence and control, a steady hand during these tragic times.
Never let a tragedy go to waste.
All that was missing from the scene, she thought, was the presidential seal on the podium.
My fellow Americans,
she began in a voice devoid of her usual New England accent.
It is with great sadness that I address you today to report yet another case of violent extremism in this great nation. This week, a respected California businessman's family was held hostage by a domestic terrorist who forced the man to wear a suicide vest onto a military installation. This act of terrorism took the life of a great American hero and the commander of all U.S. Navy SEALs, Admiral Gerald Pilsner. Tragically, the admiral's killer was one of his own SEAL officers, a disgraced extremist veteran who faces criminal charges for his negligence as a commander in combat, negligence and incompetence that led to the deaths of over 60 SEALs, Army Rangers, and Army pilots and air crewmen. It was and is the worst special operations disaster in American history. The man responsible for this unprecedented disaster is Lieutenant Commander James Reese. It is thought that his guilt over the ambush in Afghanistan drove him to target Admiral Pilsner, and it is suspected that he is also responsible for several other murders over the past weeks in Southern California, including the atrocious slaying of a peaceful Muslim cleric and another vicious killing just this week in the Florida Keys, where he took the life of another American hero, U.S. Navy Captain Leonard Howard.
Secretary Hartley paused for dramatic effect, the silence broken only by the shutter clicks of the print photographer's cameras.
Lieutenant Commander James Reese is at large and should be considered well-armed and extremely dangerous. A nationwide law enforcement effort to locate and arrest him is already in progress, but, unfortunately, the labors of our brave men and women in law enforcement are being hampered by extremists on the right who have put so-called privacy concerns over the safety of Americans from the scourge of terror. I have asked the President to sign an executive order enacting various emergency measures necessary to catch Mr. Reese and prevent others like him from murdering their fellow citizens. I also call on Congress to act swiftly to pass the Bipartisan Domestic Security Act so that we can all live safely and without fear. Since 9/11, we have looked outward for the threats of terror. This xenophobic focus on so-called foreign terrorists has caused us to overlook the true threats to liberty brewing here at home. Extremists such as Timothy McVeigh, Randy Weaver, Eric Rudolph, and James Reese should be the real targets in our fight against terror. I stand ready to defend this nation from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And with your help, we will bring James Reese to justice, or we will bring justice swiftly down upon him. I'll take your questions.
An attractive female reporter from one of the networks stood and was recognized for a question spoon-fed to her earlier by Hartley's press secretary.
Secretary Hartley, is it true that Commander Reese's pregnant wife and daughter were murdered in their home several weeks ago, and that James Reese is suspected of committing those murders?
That's right, Meredith, and yes, we do suspect that he was involved. This also brings up another point about the mental health of our men and women in uniform. Mental health and PTSD are serious issues that we as a nation must address. I call on our scientific community to dedicate their resources to addressing these problems. We need to declare war not on members of our community who are of a certain religion, but on post-traumatic stress disorder. Next question. Yes, Andrew.
Andrew Harrison was a reporter and legal expert for one of the cable news networks.
Secretary Hartley, can you confirm that James Reese used assault weapons with high-capacity clips for some of the murders in California?
Yes, Andrew. We know that he used a military-style AK-47 machine gun with an illegal clip to kill a Muslim-American cab driver in Los Angeles. That man's only offenses were having dark skin and worshiping a different god. Now his wife is without a husband, and his children are without a father. One more question.
William Brantley was the elder statesman of American broadcasters, with a career that spanned back to his time as a young war correspondent in the closing days of the Vietnam War.
Madam Secretary, perhaps this isn't the time for such a question, but you've led this nation steadfastly through so many tragedies. Will you announce for us your intention to run for President of the United States?
Don't lay it on so thick, William. Thanks, William, but this isn't about me. This is about the American heroes who have paid the ultimate price to defend our nation. This is about bringing a terrorist to justice. Thank you all. God bless the victims of these tragedies, and God bless the United States of America.
The secretary stood for a full 5 seconds and stared into the television cameras before turning to exit stage right.
I nailed it.
Angels Camp, California. Katie Buranek watched the secretary's speech, aghast. She was a bit shocked that Reese had apparently turned Mike Tedesco into a human claymore mine in Pilsner's office, but even more, she was disgusted by the outlandish allegations made against him. She could buy that he'd killed Pilsner and Tedesco. God knew they had it coming. But there was no way that he had anything to do with the death of his wife and child. She knew firsthand that the story about Reese murdering the cab driver was a lie, even down to what type of weapon he'd used. She was also confident that Reese was no extremist. He never once mentioned politics in any of their conversations. To paint a hero like James Reese as a xenophobic fascist was an affront to everything she knew about the man and his family, whom she so admired. It was time for her to get in the fight, this time wearing her journalist hat, working an editorial that would likely be the sole voice against the Hartleys' massive public relations machine. Chapter 65. Coos County, New Hampshire. Fred still believed in the Constitution. He had dedicated his life to supporting and defending it. Like many senior enlisted SEALs, Fred had his college degree. Unlike most SEALs, he was also working on a master's degree in philosophy, of all things. He loved history, specifically the history of warfare, but he tempered that with the peace that studying philosophy brought him. His guys sometimes called him the warrior poet, a title he wore with honor. That the president and SecDef had suspended Posse Comitatus bothered him. He was old enough to remember the fiascos that were Waco and Ruby Ridge in the early 1990s. He was just a kid at the time, but remembered the political firestorm that ensued when it was discovered that the advisors had been on the ground assisting the ATF at Waco. Federal government overreach was still something about which most Americans were extremely apprehensive. What had caused Fred even more concern was the group of men who met him and his team at Mount Washington Regional Airport in New Hampshire. 20 private security contractors from a firm called Capstone Security were awaiting him. A call back to his command confirmed that the SecDef had already personally called to ensure the SEALs would support the contractors. The reason for the support role, he was assured, was some legal necessity related to Posse Comitatus. Fred was enraged. This was complete bullshit. These security contractors were not here to apprehend Reese. They were here to assassinate him. Fred knew the law and understood the Constitution. He also knew he had pledged an oath to obey the orders of those appointed over him. It was these two conflicting allegiances that gnawed at his soul. Speeding over mountain roads brought him back to the moment.
"Slow down, Clark," he ordered gruffly. "We need to get to the target in one piece."
The UAV on loan from Department of Homeland Security showed no signs of life at the mountain cabin. Far removed from the paved roads of the New Hampshire countryside, it looked like an idyllic retreat, at least from the feed Fred was watching on the iPad mini in his lap. Fred moved his HK416 rifle to the side and tapped the transmit button on the embitter radio secured in the gear on his plate carrier.
"Lead, slow it down," he cautioned to the first vehicle in the convoy.
They all wore their gray shipboarding kit, minus any flotation, so as not to look overtly military. The gray, nondescript uniforms made them appear more like a big city SWAT team than a group of battle-hardened SEALs. The only giveaway was that each operator's helmet did not match the unexceptional gray of their uniforms and body armor. Operators could become attached to their helmets. Helmets of multicam or AOR-1 desert digital camo sat in their laps so as not to alert local citizens that war had come to town.
"What, you getting too old for this, senior?"
quipped one of the newer members of the team from the back seat of the rented Suburban.
"No, I just want us all to arrive at the drop-off point alive."
"Good copy, senior," responded the younger man.
"Hey, senior, why didn't they just use local cops to get this guy? I heard what Smitty said about him being a good operator and all, but..."
"He's only one guy, and he's just a vanilla SEAL," Clark said, using the unofficial, semi-derogatory term used to describe those SEALs and Army SOF operators not in their particular units.
"Hey," Fred responded with more emotion in his voice than he intended. "This guy is not just a vanilla SEAL. And you know I hate that term. He is an HVI, a domestic terrorist. He is our targeted individual. Do not underestimate him. Do you understand?"
"Understood, senior. That goes for everyone," Fred said, clicking his radio once more.
"Listen up, gentlemen. We are 1 hour out. Do not, I say again, do not underestimate this guy."
"Good copy," came the trail vehicle's reply. Fred settled back into his seat. The rental Suburban and Tahoe would get them as far as a drop-off point on the opposite side of a steep mountain behind the cabin. From there, they would patrol in to observe from high ground. Then they would make entry under the cover of darkness and apprehend America's most famous domestic terrorist. Reese knew they would come. He didn't know how many or exactly when, but he knew they would come. He spent little time pondering whom they would send. Would it be private contractors? A possibility. considering the resources of the conspiracy in which he found himself an unwitting pawn. Local sheriff? Reese hoped not. FBI hostage rescue team? A probability, considering they have the authority to operate on U.S. soil. Maybe, depending on how desperate the SecDef had become. Whoever came for him was a part of that conspiracy. They were coming to prevent him from completing his mission, and that was something Reese could not allow. Reese felt no allegiance to anything or anyone. His sole purpose was to make those who killed his family account for what they had done. They had taken everything from him. Now, it was his turn. When they came for him, the last piece of the puzzle would fall into place. Reese prayed he was wrong, but even before he heard the helicopter, he knew he was not. His pursuers were instruments of a group of conspirators who had subverted the system for their own benefit. Power and money were formidable motivators to those in life with no purpose other than their own self-aggrandizement. Had Reese died in Afghanistan, as they had planned, his family would still be alive. Horn and his cronies would be more wealthy than most ever dreamed possible. Admiral Pilsner would be on his way to a seat on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Lorraine Hartley would be on her way to the presidency. Unfortunately for all of them, Reese was still alive. He was alive and set on a reckoning, one that would see them all to early graves. He was nearing the end of his journey and would soon join his wife and daughter. Just a few more people to kill, and if he was right about an approaching assault force, there would be one more name to add to the list. From his elevated position, Reese had a clear view of the road leading to the remote dirt turnaround area where it appeared that hikers sometimes parked their cars. This time of year, it was empty. Reese heard the rotors of the chopper well before he saw it. Even at this distance, Reese knew what it was. The helicopter didn't surprise him, though they should have kept it farther back until the assault had commenced. What surprised him was the number of people they sent. The lead black Suburban was followed by a Chevy Tahoe and two 10-pack passenger vans. Reese watched them exit their vehicles and gather into a loose formation. These were no hikers or Boy Scouts on a field trip. These were the men sent to kill him. It was an odd conglomeration of what looked to be military or paramilitary forces and private contractors. A few stood out as professional soldiers, while others appeared to give off an air of invincibility and arrogance. Two even lit up cigarettes. He counted close to 30 attackers. It was time. The enemy had massed, was unaware, and was in the kill zone. Reese picked up the MK-186 wireless firing device that he had linked with a string of 6 Claymore mines yesterday morning. The MK-186 was bulky and old, but it worked. He had set them up in a classic L-shaped ambush, adhering to the old military adage, keep it simple. The Mark 48 7.62 machine gun lay next to him, along with his M4 with M203 grenade launcher and 2 LAW rockets. He looked back at the force readying to kill him and armed the MK-186 with the push of a button. In this game, you lived by the sword and died by the sword. The men 150 yards away and below him knew that well. It was their turn to die by the sword. Something stopped Reese cold. He pushed disarm on the MK-186 and picked up his binos. Something about the way one of the men below moved gave him pause. It looked to be the leader wearing gray op camis and gear. A bit of a beard and longer sandy hair gave him the appearance of a contractor, but his demeanor suggested something else. Reese focused the binos in on the man who was seconds away from being eviscerated into eternity. "Damn it, Fred. What are you doing down there?" Reese thought, looking down at his old sniper school partner. "Some of them are your brothers, Reese. They're hunting you, but they don't deserve to die today. They have no idea the part they are playing in this game." Without another thought, Reese dropped the binos, grabbed his M4, and disappeared into the bush, leaving an empty target for Freddie Strain to ponder. Only one person on Earth knew he was going to the cabin. Reese now knew the final name
to add to his list.
Chapter 66. Katie Buranek's story went live on a lesser-known, though legitimate news site at 5 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time. Her more mainstream outlets wouldn't touch it, fearing backlash from the administration in the name of limited access and IRS audits. Drudge picked it up by 6 o'clock a.m., and it was on all of the morning political talk shows an hour later. The conspiracy theorists bought into the story hook, line, and sinker. Talk radio hosts were jumping up and down over it by noon. Stories like this popped up all the time, but Katie's credibility as one of a few true investigative reporters left in the business gave this one legs. She didn't make accusations, despite having the evidence to do so, but instead asked the readers to think for themselves. What was a Bentley-driving political bundler with close ties to the Hartleys doing in the Warcom Admiral's office in the first place? Why didn't the Secretary of Defense acknowledge her close relationship with Tedesco during her remarks? Why would a highly decorated SEAL with a half-dozen combat deployments suddenly go rogue and start taking out members of his chain of command? She had on-the-record quotes from former commanders, peers, and subordinates of Reese, who all agreed that he would never do such a thing. A few throwing in the caveat, without a really good reason. They also agreed to a man that he would have never hurt his wife and daughter. And why would the SecDef not accept the alibi that he was at Balboa Naval Medical Center when his family was killed, as the police investigators did? Why deal in facts when you can simply issue statements that the media will parrot? Katie posed questions about Capstone Capital and its status as one of J.D. Hartley's clients. Why was a California-based private equity firm getting an annual $100 million appropriation out of his wife's budget? Wasn't the idea of having the spouse of a cabinet secretary lobbying her agency fundamentally corrupt? These questions, which the Hartleys had successfully avoided in the past, were now too juicy for the mainstream press to ignore, and could seriously damage her chances of becoming the next president. Hartley's communications staff was in full crisis mode, putting far more time and effort into this story than they ever did to any Pentagon issue. Though Hartley's close advisors were all technically DOD employees, they were political professionals who had followed her into the job and would follow her out. They decided that the best course of action was to stonewall and retaliate. They refused to acknowledge that the article, which they dismissed as fake news, raised any real issues of substance, and they attacked Buranek as a conservative bomb thrower, despite her history of equal criticism of both political parties. The secretary herself made no official statement in response to the article, instead coordinating a contrived scene with a friendly reporter as she and her staff walked into the White House for a briefing.
"These people have been attacking J.D. and me for years, and they've always lied. Conservatives can't swallow that the real threats to America are among their own ranks. They're focused on foreign threats when we are radicalizing our own citizens into extremism through talk radio and the Internet. This blogger is part of the problem, not part of the solution. We can be free from this fear with the passage of the Domestic Security Act." Chew on that, Katie, whatever your name was.
Chapter 67. Bennington County, Vermont.
"What kind of a shopping list is this, Reese?"
asked a skeptical Liz Riley. Reese smiled.
"It's one for the ages, Liz. Any questions about it?"
Liz and Reese had flown from Florida to a small private airport in Vermont used mostly by retired locals with a passion for flying and a few wealthy families from New York and Connecticut who liked to escape to the woods on the weekends. They were able to rent a small private hangar to use as a home base while preparing the final phase of their mission. Liz arranged it en route and explained to the manager that they were doing a site survey for her boss for an upcoming retreat. After Reese aborted the ambush of the assault force sent to take him out at Ben's cabin, he made his way back to Liz at the airfield to begin final preparations for the remainder of the list.
A glassware chemistry set, round bottom flask, catch flask, clamps?
It's for distillation, explained Reese. Liz raised an eyebrow and continued.
Plastic 5-gallon bucket, a wooden broom, fertilizer, high-yield stunt remover, liquid fire drain cleaner, a bedsheet set, a string of Christmas tree lights, a hot glove, 15-inch long, 6-inch diameter plastic PVC pipe with collar, copper bowls, coffee filters, candles, cold packs. You sure you need all this?
Reese just nodded. Any questions?
Let me see. Concrete cleaner, pool cleaner, hydrogen peroxide, a set of shot glasses, a heat lamp, a wireless doorbell. Are you doing what I think you are doing, Reese?
Probably. Don't worry, Liz. This is for one person in particular. It will be precise and is meant to send a message.
You certainly know how to send a message, my friend. Okay. I'm on it. Guessing you want me to spread this around and not pick it all up at Terrorism R Us?
He ignored her attempt at humor. I've already identified the chemistry equipment on Craigslist. Just explain that your high school kid loves science and asked for a set for his birthday. Pretend like you have no idea what it's for. Everything else, spread out and pay cash. We still have plenty from the stash that Marco gave us. I have a list of stores here that should carry what we need, Reese said, handing Liz the list, which included addresses. It's going to be a long day, Liz. Even though you could get all this stuff between a couple of hardware stores, a nursery, and a radio shack, visit multiple stores in multiple towns so it doesn't look like you are doing what you are actually doing.
Is making this thing dangerous? I don't want you to blow yourself up. Or me, for that matter.
It's not without danger, I'll tell you that. Remember the EFPs in Iraq?
Of course, those fucking things, Liz said with disgust, shaking her head.
They both knew people killed and others maimed for life from the plague of explosively formed penetrators. A basic and effective weapon, EFPs consist of pipes, explosive chains, and metal plates that, when detonated, turn into molten slugs or penetrators focused from the high-velocity force of the charge and allowing them to slice through armored vehicles with ease. Although developed in World War II and later tested extensively by Hezbollah in Lebanon, they really came into their own and into the public consciousness following the invasion of Iraq. With significant assistance from Iran, they were smuggled into Iraq across centuries-old rat lines, predominantly to Shiite militias and Badr Brigade splinter groups. Introduced to that theater in force in 2005, they would defeat the world's most technologically superior armor, causing death, destruction, and psychological terror. One of the deadliest asymmetrical weapons used against Allied forces in modern times, EFPs and other improvised explosive devices accounted for more than 50% of all U.S. casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan, and untold suffering from the 33,000 physically wounded. The corresponding psychological toll was incalculable, but extended well into the hundreds of thousands. For a minor investment in personnel and material, the enemy was able to bring a superpower to its knees. This rudimentary, cheap, and relatively small tactical weapon caused damage far in excess of its size and became a weapon of strategic importance. Reese had spent years of his life pressuring the enemy threat network in Iraq, mapping out, dismantling, and destroying IED cells throughout the country. Now on home soil, he planned to turn this weapon against one of the men who stood to profit from the deaths of his troop and his family.
And I need you to do me a big favor, Liz. I need you to get in touch with Rafe.
Liz paused. Rafe had been like a brother to Reese in the teams. They had met in college and entered the Navy together, one as an officer and one enlisted. An event in Iraq years earlier had caused Rafe to leave the SEAL teams under circumstances no one but Reese fully understood.
Are you sure that's a good idea? Do you think he will help?
I know he will. It will just be better coming from you. You might have to do a little sleuthing to track him down. You can get to him through his family offices if you get creative. I hate to add this to everything else I need you to do today, but it's the only way.
I got it, Reese. I still have his sister's contact information, so I'll get through to him somehow.
Great. When you do, read him this, Reese said, handing Liz a folded-up note. It's detailed instructions and a big ask, but I know he'll do it.
I sure hope so,
Liz said, reading through the note with a hint of skepticism in her eyes. Oh, and we need a sprinter van.
Oh, just a sprinter van?
Liz quipped. I located a used one online not far away. It doesn't have the New York plates that I'm looking for, but we can steal some along the way.
Won't buying it in cash seem suspicious?
Possibly. It's a year old, and it looks like the guy just needs money. If it does arouse suspicion by the time it's followed up on, it will be too late. I just need something that can blend into the New York delivery vehicle scene, and this should be perfect. Liz looked at the floor, opened her mouth to say something, and then stopped. Liz, inquired Reese.
James, what happens when this is over?
Focus on the mission, Liz.
I knew you would say that,
she said, with a hint of disappointment in her voice. I'm sorry you were so deep into this, Liz. That was never my intention. And it's my one regret about this whole thing.
Fuck you, James. I am in this because I choose to be. I want to be here, and I want to take these guys down. They have it coming.
Reese nodded. First thing we need to do is get you a wig or something for your shopping spree today. They will eventually piece this together, Liz. Have no misconception about that. A disguise might just slow them down a bit. I've talked with Marco. When this thing goes south, and Liz, it will go south, he's got a place for you in Mexico. I've been there. It's not the States, but you will run his Mexico flight operations and live on his estate south of Puerto Vallarta. He has lawyers who can help work on a deal to get you back to the U.S. and keep you out of prison. Whatever they tell you to tell investigators about me, do it. Unfortunately, that's the best I can do for you. Liz bowed her head again. It was a lot to take in.
Focus on the mission, Reese,
she said, turning to go borrow the airfield's loaner car. It took Liz a full day and into the evening to track down everything on Reese's grocery list. They had driven together to the home of the man selling the Sprinter van. Apparently his wife was not as excited about converting it into a small camper van as he was, so he was selling it to get them something she would enjoy as well. He had purchased it as a cargo van so he could outfit it himself, which made it ideal for the job Reese had in mind. If he thought it was odd that Reese stayed in the airport's vehicle, he didn't let on. He was just happy someone was willing to pay cash for his impulse buy. After Liz acquired the Sprinter, she switched vehicles with Reese and began her quest for the items on her shopping list. When Liz returned to the hangar later that evening, she found Reese securing something to the inside of the Sprinter van. It was a desk he had liberated from a small office attached to the hangar. On the wall of the hangar was the outline of what appeared to be a large SUV.
What's up, Reese?
Just getting prepped. How'd it go? Any problems? Reese asked.
Surprisingly few. I did some quick research on the more obscure items and came up with a backstory in case anyone started asking questions. Most of the guys were extremely helpful.
I'll bet, Reese said with a knowing gleam in his eye.
They all just seemed happy someone was buying their stuff,
Liz said with a grin. Great. And how'd it go with Rafe?
I got through to his sister, Victoria. She gave me his current contact numbers and said she would pass on the information. We also coordinated a place for me to drop off your gear for Rafe after we part ways here. That was the best I could do.
He'll take care of it.
I sure hope so. How's your science experiment preparation going?
I'll be able to build the device with the materials you picked up today. Remember the July 7th bombings in London a few years back? Similar stuff. Though this one will be targeted and more precise. I am in no way an explosives expert, so I want you to stay clear as I do this. I could very well blow myself sky high.
You're a Navy SEAL, for Christ's sake. Can't you build a bomb that won't blow us up?
We have EOD guys that are the real experts in this sort of thing. I learned all this from studying the enemy overseas, taking down their bomb factories. They don't quite take the precautions we would here in our explosives courses in the States. Every now and then the enemy would do our job for us and blow themselves up by being careless. I wish I had a few more blocks of C4, but I used what I had on the Admiral, and my claymores are back in the New Hampshire woods, so I'll have to do this the insurgent way.
What's this?
Liz asked.